The headlines: Israeli forces killed 10 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank in the deadliest day of the regime violence in years. Iran censures some regional countries for using a fake name for the Persian Gulf, saying the move contravenes a principle of good neighborly relations. And the UK and Canada say they will send heavy tanks to Ukraine, following suit with similar decisions by the US and Germany.
Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
There appears to be no end in sight to deadly crimes of Israelis against Palestinians. The regime forces have killed yet another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. 22-year-old Yusuf Yahya was shot dead while participating in a protest against the Jenin refugee camp. His death brings the total number of those killed on Thursday by Israeli forces to 10, marking it the deadliest day of the new year. Israeli troops have barred medical teams from reaching the area. Regime forces also stormed hospitals in Jenin and internationally intentionally fired tear gas towards the pediatric department. Separately, Israeli forces demolished a sports club in the refugee camp. Palestinians have held the funeral for those recently killed by regime forces. The recent raid on the Jenin refugee camp comes a day after Israeli forces shot dead 2 Palestinians in separate attacks in the West Bank. 30 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied territories since the beginning of the year 2023. Political commentator Saad Nimer says the Palestinians need to unite under one flag to bolster resistance.
Yes, it is called massacre, and nothing less than a massacre. What happened today, it's not only the 10 who was killed in Jenin, but also we have another one in Ram, and also a child in Gaza who was affected by raid earlier last year. Well, we have always ways to react, and we should understand the reaction. First thing first, the resistance. The resistance should continue and should be escalated against the Israeli, and they should know that they should pay the price for all crimes they are committing against the Palestinian people. This is the first thing. Secondly, and most importantly, I think, instead of going to plea to the international community, come and help us, we should help ourselves. Mahmoud Abbas, as a president, should declare today, not even tomorrow, that all Palestinian factions should be united and to end this separation between Gaza and West Bank and to reunify all Palestinian factions under one general command in all of Palestine, West Bank and Gaza. And this will put the Israelis and put them in freak, definitely, and will make them really very angry. Thirdly, to have a kind of a strategy to know where are we going and what we are going to do and what are our means of doing that. And definitely resisting the occupation and resisting this entity or this regime.
Reactions are pouring in from across Palestine over the Israeli regime's latest deadly raid on the Jenin refugee camp. Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad has condemned the atrocity.
Our resistance will carry on and shall not back off from confronting this Zionist occupier, and the killing will not intimidate us and will not be intimidated by these threats made by the criminal leaders of this Zionist entity.
The Islamic Jihad and Hamas express readiness to fight back if the raid continues. The Palestinian presidency has weighed in on the matter, calling the aggression a, quote, organized massacre. It has urged the international community to intervene. The Palestinian Authority has also called on the international community to hold Israel accountable for its actions. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, said the Palestinians ended security conditions with Israel following the raid. Iran has censured some regional countries for using a fake name for Persian Gulf, saying the move contravenes the principle of good neighborly relations. The foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani made the remarks in reaction to the use of the fake name for Persian Gulf, saying that some Iranians in the foreign ministry have sent an official memo to the Iraqi state, describing as a move unacceptable. Iran has stressed, the top Iranian diplomat, that the Persian Gulf has been known by this name for thousands of years, and in ancient history and documents, maps and televlogs also are the same. Kanani added that using such, quote, baseless words cannot change reality. He said that Iraqi officials should not try to win over the other countries, but and the friendship of them at the cost of historical solidarity among regional states. Earlier in our news review program, we took a closer look at Western hypocrisy when it comes to freedom of speech, with the Holy Quran being promoted in some European countries. The desecrating of it is being promoted. Let's take a listen.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran in European countries that claim to advocate human rights and freedom. Addressing a conference in Tehran, Raisi said the act of sacrilege was an insult to the entire Abrahamic religions. He said similar cases where desecration is done in the name of freedom of expression are, quote, the worst type of insult to humanity. The Iranian president said disrespecting the Quran or any divine religion is, quote, abhorrent act. This against the backdrop of burning and tearing apart of copies of the Holy Quran by two far-right politicians in Stockholm at The Hague. The sacrilegious acts have angered Muslims around the world. Masoud Shajar from the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London joins us. We also have Said Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, also joining us from London. Welcome to you both, gentlemen. Said Mohsen Abbas, the people who might commit anti-Islam acts, which in this case have been, unfortunately, the tearing apart of the Islam's holy book, the Quran, might not even be aware that the higher-ups perhaps are using them, that they're going ahead with this act, but they're indirectly contributing for the political motive of the higher-ups or higher echelons, which is to demonize Islam and to pretty much send out the message that, hey, Muslims, we're putting you on check. You don't think that you can elevate your status to where you'd like it to be. Is that a correct way of looking at this?
I think that's correct. Rasmus Paludin, who runs the hardline party, the Danish hardline party, he's been convicted for racism and defamation laws before. He's tried to burn a Quran before in a Muslim area, that time he was thwarted, I think. And he claims he's done a stunt to basically show his party's opposition to immigration and to stand up for free speech. I mean, what on earth has burning the holy book got to do with freedom of speech? You could find a million other ways to demonstrate your ire in terms of immigration. I mean, there's no connection. So clearly this chap, who was then given a license, literally given a license by the Swedish government to go ahead with this burning, I mean, with their blessing, the Swedish government essentially has sponsored a hate crime. They're hate mongering, they're inciting violence against Muslims in this way by having people freely being able to go around burn their books. And the next stage is, do you want to burn Muslims as well? You know, these are extremists who've been given a free rein. under the cloak of freedom of expression, you know, and the reality is that they would censor you for having ordinary opinions around anything from COVID through to climate change and even your views on Ukraine or Iranian rioters. I mean, these days you'll get censored in the West for any of these things. You could even be prosecuted, to be honest. But here, suddenly, they're very, very concerned about freedom of speech when it comes to, you know, defaming Muslims and causing essentially a potential sort of disorder situation. And this is something absolutely across Europe that is a trend that has been set. Sweden, though, isn't just guilty of hate crimes in terms of religion. They've already been pulled up by a UN committee on the elimination of racial discrimination for basically being, promoters of racist hate speech, you know, against Afro-Swedes, Jews, Muslims, and Romas as well. Their hate crime levels, it should be noted, are increasing. You know, year on year, they seem to go up many percentages, and it's a substantial amount of hate crime that's going on there in Sweden as well. And they've also been, of course, pulled up and found guilty by the European Court of Human Rights on breaching European conventions on human rights as well, around social labor issues and many others. So the Swedes are not squeaky clean in terms of human rights, and yet these are the same sort of people who will go around lecturing the likes of the Islamic Republic of Iran and incite and be involved with deep state actions to create terror and to create sort of human rights violations of their own in foreign countries, especially Muslim ones.
Well, you know, Master Shajar, I mean, my question is in no way trying to imply that violence needs to be used, but there's going to be some Muslims somewhere in the world who's going to get so offended by this act, and I'm not going to name a country because I don't want to vilify that country in a sense, but you're going to have Muslims that are going to get so offended that they may commit some kind of act against that goes against the national security of countries that are committing the acts. Isn't that something that the countries that are not really coming out and voicing against this act jeopardizing their own security?
Well, I mean, it's quite clear that Muslims around the world, a quarter of the population, they're being bombarded day in, day out, that they are second-class citizens, they don't matter, their interest is undermined, they're being abused, they're being sort of abused day in, day out. Eventually, this sort of abuse against this such a large proportion of community around the world, it's going to have consequences. There's definitely, that is how things operate. And, you know, I remember at the time of Salman Rushdie, when some Muslims actually in Britain and elsewhere were burning the satanic verses, we were being told clearly by the Westerners and Europeans that in their culture, burning a book resembles Nazism, and indeed burning a book means being against freedom of speech and freedom of expression. Now, Muslims who are opposing the holy book of Muslims being burned, we are being told the exact opposite, that we are against freedom of speech, and burning the Quran is an expression of freedom of speech and freedom of expression. This is madness. This is sort of such a double standard, which is crazy. But nevertheless, the authorities, be it in Sweden or elsewhere, are not really waking up to their hypocrisy. Uh-huh. And they're actually supporting this.
Thank you very much for that, Sami Hossein Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Master Shajar, a pleasure. Islamic Human Rights Commission from London. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
UK and Canada say they will send heavy tanks to Ukraine following similar decisions by the United States and Germany. The British government says it will spend 14 Challenger 2 tanks by the end of March. It added that training Ukrainian soldiers in how to use and maintain those tanks will start next week. Canada, for its part, said it will supply heavy tanks to Ukraine, starting with a shipment of 4 fully operational German Leopards. The new development came after Germany promised to provide Ukraine with its Leopard tanks by the end of March. Following Berlin's announcement, the U.S. said that it would send 31 Abrams tanks to bolster Ukraine in its war with the Russians. The British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, hoped that London's decision would serve as a catalyst for other countries to follow suit. Russia has dismissed as, quote, provocation, a report by the UN nuclear watchdog about powerful explosions near Ukraine's Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. The reaction came after head of the International Atomic Energy Agency claimed the vicinity of the plant had been rocked by 8 strong explosions. An advisor to the head of the company that operates Russia's nuclear plant, Rafael Grossi's comments were unfounded. Renat Kecha says Grossi's remarks were aimed at convincing a Western public opinion that Russia cannot uphold safety of the nuclear power plant. Zaporizhzhia is the largest nuclear power plant in Europe and among 3 of the largest Russian forces power plants in the world. Russian forces took control of the plant soon after the Ukraine war started in February 24th. The U.S. president has called for protests to be peaceful after 5 police officers were charged in the death of a black man following a traffic stop. Joe Biden said the investigations show that people are outraged at the incident, adding that, however, the violence is never acceptable. He admitted that more steps must be taken to ensure that in the United States criminal system, as part of an impartial Biden remark, came after 5 officers charged with a second-degree murder over the death of 29-year-old Aaron Nicholas on January 7th. His family says Nicholas was so brutalized by police that he was completely unrecognizable. Nicholas was taken to the hospital in critical condition, where he died, actually, 3 days later. Police brutality against the people of color has been a major source of public outrage in the U.S. This issue has caused more strong reactions to the 2020 death of George Floyd. He was a 46-year-old black man who was murdered by police in Minneapolis.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is under pressure to drop the charges against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Many human rights organizations have expressed their opposition to the extradition and trial of Julian Assange in the United States. But the Biden White House has not paid any attention to these requests. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Joe Biden has been charged with hypocrisy for demanding the release of journalists detained around the world, as he continues to seek the extradition of the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, from Britain. As a candidate in 2020, Biden released a powerful statement about the importance of press freedom. Joe Biden said, "At least 360 people worldwide are currently imprisoned for their work in journalism. We all stand in solidarity with these journalists." On Friday, 20th of January 2023, the campaign aimed to pressure Joe Biden to drop charges against Julian Assange, move to Washington, D.C. for the hearing of the Belmarsh Tribunal, the gathering of legal experts and supporters named after the London prison where Julian Assange is being detained. Organized by Progressive International in partnership with the Wau Holland Foundation, it was held at the National Press Club close to the U.S. Capitol building, which houses the U.S. Congress. The hearing was held in the same venue where Julian Assange in 2010 exposed the collateral murder video showing U.S. aircrew gunning down Iraqi civilians, the first of hundreds of thousands of leaked secret military documents and diplomatic cables published in major newspapers around the world. Collateral murder is 39 minutes of unedited leaked video footage from a gun cam that had caused severe embarrassment in Washington as it showed the U.S. military drone attacking Al-Amin al-Thaniya, a suburb of Baghdad, and killing 12 innocent Iraqi civilians. The Belmarsh Tribunal co-chairperson, Sireko Horvat, said, "President Biden is normally advocating freedom of the press, but at the same time continuing the persecution of Julian Assange." He also warned that continuing the prosecution could serve as a bad example to other governments around the world. He said, "This is an attack on press freedom globally. That's because the United States is advancing what I think is really the extraordinary claim that it can impose its criminal secrecy laws on a foreign publisher who was publishing outside of the United States." Currently, Julian Assange faces 18 charges over WikiLeaks' publication of classified documents, most of which were leaked by former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning. Manning has stated that she acted on her own initiative in sending the documents to WikiLeaks and not at the urging of Assange. She was sentenced to 35 years in prison, but was later released after former President Barack Obama commuted her sentence in 2017. The Bloomberg News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. The campaign to free WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is being stepped up following support from the presidents of all major Latin American countries. The politicians have sided with the Free Assange campaign in urging U.S. President Joe Biden to drop the charges against Assange and set him free. Assange is being held in Belmarsh Prison in London, England, as he continues to fight being extradited to the United States. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva said, "Julian Assange needs to be defended by all of us who love democracy, who love freedom of the press, freedom of trade unions, who love freedom of organization." WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Christine Hafenson and WikiLeaks ambassador Joseph Farrell have held a series of meetings in recent weeks in Latin American countries, including Mexico, Bolivia, Brazil, and Argentina. The Mexican president raised the issue of Julian Assange at a recent summit with Joe Biden and has used his daily briefing to highlight his continuing unjust detention. President of Argentina Alberto Fernandez said, "For justice to be done, the United States needs to drop the charges against Julian Assange and put an end to the ongoing extradition proceedings." Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, said, "If Assange is taken to the United States and sentenced to the maximum penalty, we must begin the campaign to dismantle the Statue of Liberty. It is no longer a symbol of freedom." Meanwhile, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has been approaching U.S. government officials to persuade them to drop the espionage charges filed against Julian Assange. Anthony Albanese said recently that he had raised the issue of the continued detention of Julian Assange in meetings with U.S. officials and was seeking to bring the matter to a close. Albanese said he would continue to advocate for Julian Assange's release. American officials claim his journalism endangered America's national security with the release of classified documents in 2010. Julian Assange's supporters say he's a hero victimized for exposing U.S. war crimes in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. If extradited to the United States, he would face a sentence of up to 175 years in a maximum security prison. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered this story and tells us more. Major news outlets like The New York Times have called on the Biden administration to drop charges against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The Guardian, Le Monde, Der Spiegel, El País all joined forces with The New York Times to oppose the charges against Julian Assange, insisting that publishing the material WikiLeaks has released is not a crime. The media outlets wrote recently, "Obtaining and publishing sensitive information is a core part of the daily work of journalists." On 28th of September 2010, the five major news outlets collaborated to release excerpts from 250,000 documents obtained by Julian Assange in the Cablegate leak. The material, leaked to WikiLeaks by the then American soldier Chelsea Manning, exposed the inner workings of U.S. diplomacy around the world. The editors and publishers of the five major newspapers that first published those revelations insisted that the prosecution of Julian Assange is a direct attack on media freedom. They wrote, "This indictment sets a dangerous precedent and threatens to undermine America's First Amendment and the freedom of the press." They added, "Obtaining and disclosing sensitive information when necessary in the public interest is a core part of the daily work of journalists. If that work is criminalized, our public discourse and our democracies are made significantly weaker." The letter concluded by saying, 12 years after the publication of Cablegate, it is time for the U.S. government to end its prosecution of Julian Assange. Recently, supporters of Assange gathered to form a human chain outside the British Parliament, the House of Commons in London, to demand his release and an end to an attempt by the United States to have him extradited to face criminal charges in the U.S. The protesters, who held posters reading "Free Assange, End Extradition," "Journalism is not a crime," and "Prosecute war crimes, not Julian Assange," formed the human chain that stretched from the House of Commons perimeter railings and led towards nearby Westminster Bridge to the other side of the River Thames.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady. You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم. Dear ladies, welcome to a new episode of your favorite program, in which we're talking about ladies, and the greatest of all these ladies is Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, whom we have been talking about for quite some sessions, it has been, sister. And here with me, I have Sister Zainab, of course. Welcome, sister, and salam alaikum.
Walaikum assalam. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad to be with you, Sister
Asma. Of course, the pleasure is all mine. In the very last episode, we talked about the process of marriage, the proposal, and then the wedding. And then we talked about it, that it already has to be something simple, and we shouldn't take it so hard and so ostensible. So now let's go a little bit deeper in this bond that has been created after marriage, how we should treat the other person. As a Muslim lady, I get into a relationship with a man and they're the same roof, and we're going to be called each other's alter ego. So definitely the way I am going to treat my husband is going to be so important. And since we are talking about Lady Fatima, salamullah alayha, shall you share some of the points of her relationship with her husband?
Yes, we had been quite a long time talking about the behavior of Lady Zahra Salamu alayha with her husband, but we actually could not talk about the behavior itself, because we first wanted to say how she chose the husband, how simple their wedding was, where all her criteria in choosing a good husband. Because choosing a partner is actually that starts...
is the most important part of the story.
Yeah, it's all about like how your partner could be your best husband, because if you're choosing him on the basis of spirituality rather than materialism on the top of the list, the things would go
smoother.
Yeah, even in the, like, we talked about the function of marriage, and also there was kind of, you know, there was a lot of cooperation in the marriage, and that should be done in even today's functions. One of the basic things that's important for the family strength is to respect each other.
Yeah.
And this respect was seen so much in the family of Lady Zahra salamu alayha, that both of them, not just one of them, both of them showed extreme amount of respect towards each other. There are some of the quotes that say that on her deathbed, when she was lying on her deathbed and she was crying extremely, she was shedding a lot of tears, and then Imam Ali alayhi salam comes to her and tells her, He addresses her as, "Ya Sayyidi, why are you crying?" So Sayyidi means my leader. She would often call him as Ya Sayyidi in her life. And now here, on her deathbed, he is telling her, "Ya Sayyidi, what makes you cry?" And then she replies that in all these years that I have been with you, which was 9 years, according to the most approved codes, I never ditched you. I never deceived you. I never lied to you, nor did I make you angry. And then Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "My dearest wife, what are you saying? What does it mean to deceive? What does it mean to lie? What does it mean to make angry? Anta a'lamu billahi wa akram wa atqa wa ashadu lillahi khawfa." He says that, you know, you are the most knowledgeable. You are the most honorable. You're the person with taqwa. Who has never committed any, you know, sins, done any kind of wrongdoing, always committed the obligatory things. In terms of fear of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you have the highest level.
Yeah.
Now see the behavior with wife, how he is treating her, how he sees her, how he addresses her.
Now, so it's all about respect. Now, before you just continue the rest of that narration, let's go for a short break, after which we'll be back. Thank you, dear Muslim ladies.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to Muslim Lady in here. Sister Zainab and I are talking about the relationship of a husband and wife, specifically Lady Fatima Salamullah alayha and Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, and their house and how everything went on between them.
Yes, so I was saying the beautiful words they would address to each other in the times of, in the worst times, like in the saddest times. I started with that because in the disappointing times, in the saddest times, we lose our temper. We are not us.
We're short of temper, and then everything happens to be so miserable.
When we are down, we don't see things. We really don't understand the surroundings, so...
And we don't understand the words that we are using are having too much of negativity.
Exactly. So that's why I actually started their behavior with their last part of the life, last part of her life. But throughout their life, she would always call him with very, very good names. Like she would.
Sincere names, yeah.
Yeah, she would call him Yabna Am, like you're the son of my uncle, or like, as we say, my cousin.
She will always respect him. All the adjectives used for him.
If I translate them, or the father of Hasnan, she would call him, like, in the very, like, the way she would express her love, she would call him, Ruhi li ruhi kalfida, may my soul get sacrificed for you. So she expressed her extreme love towards her husband. And also, as per her code, the best of the men and are those who have the best behavior towards their wives.
Yeah.
She describes the best men, in her opinion, are the ones who have good behavior with their wives. Not the ones like who are angry, who whatever they are like, you know.
Nagging all the time.
I mean to say they had a bad day outside and now they come home and then they...
take revenge from their family.
Yeah, who are... like who are innocent, who have done nothing. And she says, according to her, the best husbands are those who have very good behavior with their with their partners.
And also there was a lesson in what you said. You see, in many marriages, in many couples, we see that they did not show their love for each other. I don't know why, but they keep it inside, you know? They do not use nice words for each other. They don't say it to each other. Because when you say it, it's different from having it just inside your heart.
It's unfortunately media playing a very great role, which kind of shows to men that put on your ego. If man has ego, he's a man. If man does not have ego, he's not a man. And also, because mostly men are the ones who are... least expressive in terms of love. So, but even Prophet, peace be upon him, says that, say to your wives in the Uhib book, I really love you and all. But, you know, in her entire life, we were talking about her behavior with her husband. You asked me this. She was extremely respectful, number one. She was extremely loving. And she would, whenever she would find Imam Ali alayhi salam crying, she gets very nervous. She gets very worried and says in weariness that, may your eyes never get teary. Whenever Imam Ali, on the command of Prophet, peace be upon him, would go on some war front and in some battle and would come back, she would actually, whenever he would go, she would get very, very nervous. All the wives of the martyrs know, how is it to send your husband on the war front?
Yeah.
How is it to live a life wherein you don't know, is your husband coming back or not? All those wives know, how is it, how difficult it is. So it has not been easy for Lady Fatima Zahra. It's been very, very difficult for her to actually be separated for him. It all shows, and her eyes would be teary. She would shed tears when Imam Ali Sam would go out in his love. So she expressed her love, not in her just words, not in just addressing him, not in just praying for him, but also she would express her love
from all the features of her face,
like just shedding tears. And you know, like talking about the marriage, when Prophet, peace be upon him, told her, he asked both, how did you find each other? She says, I found Ali the best husband. And Imam Ali alayhi salam says that, I found her the best partner of spirituality.
Yeah. Now, does this is love now.
Yeah, this is love. Now, does this mean that she carried out prayers on his behalf? That's why she was a good spiritual partner? It never means that. It means like, you know, how can I call my partner to be a best spiritual help?
Yeah, so before we get into the gist of the final part, let's go listen to something and then we'll be back. Ladies, you are listening to your program. Well, Sister Zainab, is there still anything remaining regarding the relationship between the husband and wife?
So I was saying, when Prophet, peace be upon him, asked her, how did you find each other after marriage? She says, I found Ali alayhi salam to be the best husband. And he also says, I found her the best spiritual partner.
Yeah, and we said this is the pure love.
Yeah, and this does not mean that she would go and offer prayers in on his behalf, which is not possible. What I mean by that, or what he means by that is like, see, for example, you can be a best guide. You as a Muslim lady could be a best spiritual partner for your husband. How? You can wake up early, go for night prayers, and when your husband sees this, you can help him. Maybe he wanted to for a long time, but when he sees you doing that...
Yeah, it's a motivation. It's a driving force.
Yeah, so you can actually, in the spiritual activities, you can act as a driving force. That's what Imam Ali alayhi salam tries to say over here. She's the best spiritual partner. She's the best, my best guide in the spirituality here. He means that whenever he sees her, his urge becomes more.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And this is all about marriage, you know. You should be the wings of each other. You should fly together and then help the other one fly with you as well.
Exactly.
So in all the goodness. So this was all about today's session. I guess there's still a lot to talk about the relationship and how to make it perfect. But I guess the remaining part is going to be on other sessions. Thank you, Sister Zainab, and thank you, dear listeners.
Thank you so much.
I hope you're enjoying your lifetime. Muslim ladies, try to be the perfect version of yourself. And then, thank you. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the love one?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our example.
Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain is preparing to step down in the coming weeks, according to a report from the New York Times. Ron Klain, a longtime advisor to President Joe Biden, supported Biden through his 2020 presidential campaign and has helped guide his administration since he was elected to office. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain is preparing to step down in the coming weeks, according to a report from the New York Times. Klain, a longtime advisor to President Joe Biden, supported Biden through his 2020 presidential campaign and has helped guide his administration since he was elected to office. After the midterm elections in November and an action-packed 2 years in the White House, Ron Klain has told colleagues that he's ready for something different. A search for Klain's replacement is reportedly underway, but it is not clear if a successor has already been chosen or when the decision will be announced. Ron Klain previously acted as Biden's chief of staff during former President Barack Obama's first term, and he's worked with Joe Biden since he ran for president back in 1987. Biden selected Klain as his chief of staff in November of 2020, and he has been a part of the administration's various successes and failures ever since. Klain helped to oversee the COVID-19 relief plan and vaccine distribution, the bipartisan infrastructure program, and investment in climate change while battling high levels of inflation and slowing economic growth. Ron Klain's resignation would be a significant departure in an administration that has so far avoided many turnovers. All of Joe Biden's statutory cabinet members have stayed on, and Ron Klain is proud he has lasted longer than any other Democratic president's first chief of staff in more than 50 years. Former President Donald Trump, in contrast, was on his third chief of staff, his third national security advisor, and had lost 15 of his initial cabinet secretary appointees by this point in his presidency. Ron Klain has been open about his intentions to eventually leave his post, and he will stay long enough to help the new chief of staff transition and settle in, according to the New York Times report. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Ron Klain, Joe Biden's chief of staff, is reportedly set to step down from his position in what will be the biggest change to the US president's inner circle of advisors since he took office 2 years ago. Ron Klain will announce his departure in the coming weeks, according to a New York Times report, after telling colleagues he's ready to move on following a grueling period of successes and frustrations that stretch back to Biden's successful 2020 presidential election campaign. Two hard years, Ron Klain tweeted on Friday, marking the second anniversary of Biden's inauguration. So much to be done, but so much progress. The impending exit of Ron Klain follows a period where the chief of staff worked to secure Biden's legislative priorities, including the bipartisan infrastructure bill and last year's Inflation Reduction Act, which was achieved following 18 months of often torturous negotiations between the White House and lawmakers on Capitol Hill, most notably Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. More recently, President Biden has come under scrutiny for alleged improper handling of federal documents, as well as fresh pressure from Republicans in their new majority in the House of Representatives. The new chief of staff is expected to have to mount a defense of Biden's victories so far, as well as oversee the lead-up to a likely re-election bid by the 80-year-old Joe Biden. Ron Klain, who is 61, has a long record in Democratic political circles, having been involved in both Bill Clinton's presidential campaigns, acted as chief of staff to both Al Gore and then Joe Biden when the men served as vice presidents previously. Klain, a lawyer by training, also oversaw the Obama administration's response to an outbreak of Ebola in 2014. He was named as Joe Biden's chief of staff just a few days after the 2020 election victory was secured. The Intelligencer has also covered this story. White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain is expected to step down in the coming weeks, according to senior Biden administration officials. A search for Ron Klain's successor is reportedly already underway, and it's not yet clear if that decision has already been made. Ron Klain's departure will mark the first and likely most significant change among Joe Biden's senior staff since the president took office just over 2 years ago. The New York Times has reported that Mr. Klain takes pride that he has lasted longer than any other Democratic president's first chief of staff in more than half a century. The Biden White House has also seen none of the tumultuous turnover that Donald Trump's cabinet underwent by the midpoint of his presidency, including the ouster of two chiefs of staff. Ron Klain, a 61-year-old, is seen as a critical force behind the Biden administration's legislative victories and several other major initiatives, including its pandemic response. The longtime Biden aide has also been, by far, the White House's most prolific and conspicuous Twitter user. The replacement candidates reportedly under consideration include Labor Secretary Marty Walsh, former Delaware Governor Jack Markell, former White House COVID Response Coordinator Jeffrey Zients, White House Domestic Policy Advisor Susan Rice, Biden counselor Stephen Ricchetti, and senior Biden advisor Anita Dunn, who has apparently already waved off the potential role.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.